Hello there, and welcome to Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate your time. Appreciate you tuning in, whatever you're doing. Hope you're having a great day, great time, wherever you are. I love this guest. This is, I don't know, what when I thought about doing this 10, 15 years ago, it's been a while, I thought this would be such a wonderful way to connect people and to share stories that we may not have access to except at a certain time in our lives. I wanted to somehow track what it was like for people who were getting ready, who were dying, and what their thoughts might be and what their experiences would be. And I knew I was just not in a place that would give me that kind of intimate access. I heard about it like, oh, 86 or something. I was working at a, maybe it was at 82. Wow, time flies. Anyway, a woman came in and she said that they had been to the hospital. And during that time, when the relative passed, they saw ball lightning leave the body and go under the door, out of the room. And that was it. I'm like, wow. Well, I bookmarked it, filed it, and continued to research and pay attention and listen. And there were so many other things that I heard that happened during the transition time and the times that I have experienced my own personal encounters with relatives. But Becky Hawkins has been doing for 30 years something that gives her a whole lot of insight and credibility in terms of what her position as a caregiver is, with these stories and with the people that she's sharing their lives, sharing the little breadcrumbs that say, look, there's more here. Becky, I'm so glad that you are doing what you're doing, because, you know, there's no way I could do all of the things that you have brought to the table and in being there so intimately for people who need somebody to just share the time and space as they make a transition. It's a very special role that you have, in my opinion. And thank you.
Thank you.
So on the YouTube, I happened to stumble across, I was doing a little background on the Eben Alexander story, and I've talked to him before. He's a great interview. And no matter what the controversy is at the time you hear this, you know, when we have our own experiences, we just kind of let the media run amok. And know that it gets more attention when that happens. But there was a video of you doing a presentation in Sedona and something that you hadn't intended to do in the first place. And then it was such a wonderful presentation. I thought, this is excellent. So it led me to your book. The book is Transitions, A Nurse's Education About Life and Death. So can you give us an example, a setup of what, how this all got started for you?
Well, I just did not know what to do. I couldn't afford to go to college whenever I first got out of high school, and the only opening in the newspaper ads was as a nurse's aide in a nursing home. And I started working there, and I fell in love with it. It was very, very hard work, but I fell in love with that. It took me about 7 years to get to go to nursing school, and my very first job out of nursing school was on an oncology floor in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And again, I fell in love with it. I mean, these patients and these families were so, so dear to me. And that's where I started understanding that my gifts leaned more towards those who were going to be in transition. And we didn't have a hospice up and running yet. So when that hospice started, I saw their first patient, and there again, I fell in love with these patients, these families, and was so blessed by these experiences. And then later on, I did more work in outpatient oncology, more hospice work, became a hospice chaplain as well, volunteer program, helped get one of those going. And now I'm retired, and I just visit people.
But those visits are super special.
They are very special to me. Family members, neighbors, friends that I've known for a long time. Yes, each one special. And I feel somewhat like a doula. you know, that that I'm with these people in this birthing process of returning home, this change, this transition. And to me, it's like holy ground every time.
Now, okay, I've heard the word doula before. What is the the definition?
Yes, that's where the midwife comes in.
Okay.
And to help the baby be born. And so this is the way I felt in this situation is with these people, is that I wasn't forcing anybody to end their life. I wasn't forcing a transition, but I was present to this transitioning time, just to be with these people and their family members. And so honored to get to do that. It's a huge gift, a huge blessing. Yes, it's hard. But the gift that is wrapped up in some of that angst is worth everything.
I like the stories that you shared in your presentation in Sedona, and a couple of them have to do with, just right there in the trenches, you have to do a nail trim.
Yes,
yes. And I like your response of, I'm going to be a nurse, and you're asking me to do this? what am I? You're still here. This is part of the job.
Yes,
with the guy. Yes. And I love him, his energy, his enthusiasm, and everybody thinks he's just, you know, off the deep end. Could you share that story? Just, you know, that one is maybe a good way to open.
Yes, I enjoyed that gentleman very much. We were in the psychiatric ward, and my little fellow was manic depressive. And they said, Becky, you need to go in and trim his toenails because he's going to have surgery tomorrow, and they want you to do that. And I said, you're kidding. I said, that's what you want me to do? And she said, yep. And I said, okay. So I went in there, and the little fellow was just caught. He was in his manic phase, just up and down the hallways. Praise God, give all your money to Oral Roberts. You know, give God all the glory. I'm going to heaven tomorrow. And just wild. And I finally got him to sit down in his chair, and I had the warm, sudsy water, and I was getting his feet in there and sudsing them all up, and he's just giving God all kinds of glory all the while we're doing this. You know, all the while I'm trying to get him all comfortable there with everything I needed. Well, in the doorway to the wing where he is, a gentleman steps in, and my little patient says to him, hey, buddy, where you been? What's been going on? What are you doing? Well, this fellow, I found out later, was a paranoid schizophrenic or had that diagnosis. And he walks over to us, and he hits my little fellow right between the eyes with his fist. And blood starts going everywhere. Well, I just got under the first bed I could find. You know, I thought, I'm going to die here trying to trim somebody's toenails, and this isn't funny. And so I'm just screaming at the top of my lungs, somebody help me. So these orderlies come in, and they rescue the poor, confused gentleman and take him away. And then I looked out, and my supervisor was standing there, and she said, Becky, you can come out now. So I crawled out from underneath that bed, totally embarrassed, but still trembling. And my little patient was going, give all your glory to God. This little nurse saved my life. She screamed, and the guy went away, and it's all good. I'm going to heaven tomorrow. Just he was going on and on again. So I got him cleaned up, got him taken care of, and then when we went back to the hospital to have our little meeting, I asked my supervisor if I could go pray with him the next morning. I said, you know, I think he's kind of into prayer. And she said, yes, Becky. She said, get permission and you can go. She said, I want to know something. Did you learn something today? And I said, yes, ma'am, I did. So I went the next morning, and he was calm because they had given him his medication, pre-meds for surgery. And we prayed together, and I said, I'll be back later after I get through with my classes today. And I came back to the hospital, went to look for him, and I couldn't find him. So I went to the nurse's station and asked them where I could find him, and they said, oh, sweetheart, he died in surgery. And then that's when it hit me. Perhaps he wasn't as crazy as they all thought he was.
See, that's what's so beautiful about that. There's this ongoing thing everybody's trying to tune out and trying to tune out, and he's tuned in.
Yes.
So that little little piece right there, that little window, is what you get that a lot of us, we can't slow down, I think, long enough to be able to be present for somebody and just listen and allow them to give us these insights, or say, hey, be quiet. You know, it's the meds. It's your whatever your condition is, manic depressive, paranoid schizophrenic. I'm curious about what the guy who was paranoid schizophrenic saw, because it's obviously got his attention and he's saying, oh, you're not real, and punch the reality back into the situation. You know, that's, there's obviously something was happening there as well.
Yes, he did not like for anybody to question him about anything. No questions, no noise. He just wanted to do his deal. And so that was very disruptive to him, for that, my little patient to be asking him all those questions. And I'm like you, I don't have a clue in reality what all he's seen. When we label someone crazy, we need to think about, you know, I don't know the real picture here. Perhaps he's seeing what I can't see. Perhaps he's hearing what I can't hear. And he's been told that that's not right, so he thinks he's crazy. We need to be careful about our judgments with people.
Well, what's fascinating, and I do have a little another person that I've talked to before, David Franklin Farkas. He goes by like house cleaner, whatever, shamanistic type work. And he said one of the first jobs he had was working overnights in a psych ward. And he could see the folks, that the people who were labeled all sorts of dysfunctional, could see. And they said, you mean you see the guy over there in the corner? Yeah. Wow. None of the doctors do. You're one of us.
Oh my gosh, that would be an awesome book.
Well, it's just that part of our reality that some of us can engage, but it isn't always on demand. And so in terms of saying, you know, I'm an expert, or I can prove this, or it's authentic, that still, I think, is a bit out of our reach. But when it comes to doing the work that you do, you're able to be present and allow your companion to just share and say, look. And I think there are some other stories that really are, that articulate how that process goes. What was the one that maybe was for you the first time that you started becoming aware of how important this was for you just to be there?
That was when I was beginning my hospice work, and I went to see a minister, little Pentecostal minister, and Wendy, he was the cutest thing. Hair was really white, darling face, sweet personality, and he was not afraid of dying. He told me that. But he was dying from damage that had been done to his heart and lungs many years before with the early chemo, early radiation. And so he was failing because of that. His wife was frightened. Terribly frightened, and she would run into the kitchen anytime that we started talking about anything serious like that. But he trusted me, and he wanted to share with me, and he wanted me to share with him, you know, this is how this is going to go down. This is probably what's going to happen. He wanted to know the details. Well, I got the call a few weeks after our first contact, and the wife was very upset, very distraught. She said, I think he's dying right now. Hurry, hurry, hurry. So I tried to reassure her of everything that we had discussed, to go get the neighbor if that would help her, and that I was on my way. When I arrived and got in the front door, the neighbor ran home, and my little patient's wife ran back in the kitchen. He was purple. He was lacking oxygen in such a huge way, but he was very much alert. And he was sitting in his recliner, and he said, Becky, can you get me in my bed? His hospital bed was over by a big picture frame window, like from the 50s, and he could see his church right next there to him, and he could see this old oak tree. It was his favorite place to be. I literally picked him up and carried him to that bed. I set him up straight, and then I crawled in behind him and straddled him, and I had my hands on his shoulders. And he was gasping for air. I had my fingertips right there. And he patted my fingertips and said, Becky, do you see them? And I said, "No, sir, I don't know what you're seeing, but please tell me what you're seeing." And he raised his head up and he said, "Sweetheart, the room now is full of angels. They're all on both sides of the ceiling here." He said, "Oh," he said, "I got to go." And he hollered to his wife, "Annie, I love you. I have to go." And he raised his right arm up to the ceiling and he said, "Oh, my Lord." And he fell back against me and he was gone. That, to me, was the biggest first incident of feeling like I was very present to a veil parting and that they had come to escort him home, this precious, precious man who had spent his life trying to help others know the love of God. That, to me, is worth everything. To be present there, to sit with, to be part of that transition. People ask me, "Why do you do what you do? Why don't you do something a little lighter? Why don't you have, you know, fun every now and then and go do..." And I said, "You have no idea what a gift this is to be there, to hear their stories." And that's what I tried to share with some of the stories that these patients with their pre-death visions, telling me what they're seeing as they're leaving. The patients that had near-death experiences that were not as afraid of death and would share with me, "Let me tell you what's happened to me. They trusted me. I was not going to make fun of them. I was not going to tell them that that was a lie or a hallucination, but I was going to listen." We need to be able to be still, listen, and honor the story.
Well, what's amazing about that is there is such insight. These are ways of saying, "Hey, look at this. This is really incredible, and it's where I'm going. And eventually, you're going to go too. So don't get all worried about it, you know? Don't get all flustered and frightened." And I think some of it, when you're talking with your patients, is that they also are sharing some of their concerns if they haven't had such a, you know, a cushy ride or had some very difficult issues in their lifetime that they weren't able to reconcile. And there you are at that crossing point, at that bridge where they're saying, "What's going to happen? Am I not going to pass? Is this a failing course?" You know, and you help with that.
And in the helping, primarily, often, Wendy, it's me listening to sometimes their confessions. One gentleman told me, he said, "I know I'm close." He said, "But I have been angry at a neighbor for over 40 years, Becky." And he said, "I got to lay this down. I can't take this with me." He said, "I don't want to meet whomever I'm supposed to meet on the other side and still be carrying anger." He said, "I don't even remember for sure what it was about." He said, "I think it had to do something like with a cow or something." He said, "I can't even remember." He said, "But I am praying as I forgive this man, he will forgive me." And he said, "I'm forgiving myself as well. I'm letting go." Yes, there were these people that would share with us, "This is what I need to say. Can you hear me?" And that's the thing about rushing around in a hospital, rushing around, trying to get work done. The not taking time to listen is a loss. The gain comes in being able to hear them. And they know whether or not they can trust you. They choose who, you know.
Right.
This one will hear me. This one will accept who I am.
Well, at that point, they don't have anything to lose. They don't have any time to waste on people who are just in it for, "Oh, look at me. I'm a good person. I'm helping and I'm sacrificing to be here because I could do all sorts of wonderful things. Instead, I'm, you know, that's really transparent."
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people are just so busy. Most of the nurses that I work with were exceptional. But some people are so busy and caught up with the number of patients they have to see and the number of crises going on. You know, one time in the oncology ward, I had, I don't know, 7 patients I was trying to take care of, give chemo to, blood products, people that needed education, high-potent antibiotic therapy, all kinds of things going on. And I had this precious lady that was transitioning. In fact, I had 3 that night that were on top of all that. The other two had family members with them, and I was constantly checking on them. This lady had no one with her. It was breaking my heart. And I would go in to see her, and I'd say, I'm so sorry that I'm so busy. She said, sweetheart, I'm okay. Go take care of those people that need your help, that need that medicine. Go take care of them. I'm okay. I would go do a little bit and rush back in there. I said, I'm so sorry. What can I do for you? And finally she said to me, Becky, I am not alone. It's okay.
Yeah, that's the real deal. When, I don't know, the things that I've been able to experience with my light, there's a whole lot of angst and a lot of fear that dissolves. And you want to be able to share that with people. But when they're so caught up in their drama, you know, there's just no way to say, oh my gosh, there's so much more here right now. And if I could live the next 20 or 30 years of my life knowing that, I would do things differently. I wouldn't stress so much. I wouldn't be so angry. I wouldn't hold judgments and cast aspersions so quickly. I would say, wow.
Yes.
But maybe that's not a good time to do 20 years, but I would like to. That's what I've been doing, is this, wow. And
well, that's
and
what
that
you
way.
Are doing. Wendy, you are blessing everybody that gets to hear you, because you are so connected, and you do have the wow factor. This is what I hope I can carry with me whenever I speak, whenever I am writing, sharing in my column, whenever I get someone to purchase this book, that they can read these stories and have new hope. My hope is for people to not be afraid of death. It is a transition. And what I really appreciate about Dr. Evan Alexander is some of the phrases that stuck in my head and will be with me forever. All is well. No matter what's going on, because people have so many fears, like you said, and sometimes they're carrying them with them into mm-hmm. that transitioning time. And what you would hope is that we could understand that we are loved so unconditionally, and that we can really let go of fearing death. I think it's a good idea for us to connect ahead of time, however you want to connect with spirit, you know, whatever you want to call God. I don't think God cares what you call him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's beyond the label thing.
Yeah, yeah.
He got over it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a thing about just being connected, and then out of that flows this love that you have for other people, and we're not as judgmental, and that we can see that where they may be ugly inside their heart, they've been wounded, and they're carrying a huge weight with them, and they haven't figured out how to lay it down. And not try to fix everybody. Just understand everybody's on their own journey. I used to think I had to try to save everybody, rescue everybody, make it all well for everybody. But no, what this career has taught me is that it's more about walking alongside with, being present to, being there to not necessarily make it all better, but to sit with them as they are carrying this until they can put it down on their own power, on their own emotional understanding and growth. That is huge for me to have learned that from all these dear patients. I can't make you better, but I can sit with you.
Well, the question comes in, and you're in a part of the country you would see more Native Americans, and you're in Oklahoma. Is there a difference with the different types of religions or ethnicities as they go through this transition process, or have you noticed anything like that?
Well, I have not had the honor of being with too many of my friends, especially we have mostly Cherokees in the area that I am, and I'm part Cherokee myself. They oftentimes would separate themselves and family and their, you know, their leaders and all the people that, you know, people that are maybe are doing shaman work, and all of those people would just take care of everything in their homes. I didn't ever get to be with anyone who was passing, transitioning, because it was almost like they are thinking, you know, we got this.
We know how to do this.
But yes, they do. They have their own special ways of leading up to and that time and then the wake and the whole thing. And that's another thing, too. I'm very respectful of everybody's beliefs, everybody's faith, everybody's religions. This is what I've learned, too. This is what they bring to me in transitioning. You don't have to be one particular faith. You don't have to be one particular denomination. God is for everybody. Everybody.
And that was one of the first things that I got with this light thing, was that you can even, if you are not Catholic or not of a certain, you know, of that faith, and you can still get help from a saints, because they're non-denominational. Saints don't wear that badge anymore. They're light.
And wouldn't that be healing for so many people to understand that and receive that?
Oh, well, and it was for me, it was like, oh my gosh, because then some of the things that I have dealt with have included St. Francis, and I am not Catholic, so I didn't know about these things. I had to research things like Taoism, Catholicism, Hinduism, Buddhism, the whole nine yards, because that was one of the first things of this light engagement, was that know more about this so you can understand and let go of the divisive ways of thinking that say you are separate. You may speak a different language, but the energy is the same. That's what it's about, is the energy. And love crosses all boundaries and barriers, or boundaries and barriers.
So much, yes. Well, I believe, and I put this out everywhere I can, we are one human family. And the thing that I learned also was that we take nothing with us. I had one lady, she was a real character. She was ornery, and she would tell you she was. But she decided she planned her whole service. She said, Becky, I went down there to that funeral home, and I found out right quick that there's no luggage racks on those coffins.
Yeah.
I love that. But she said, we're not taking any of this stuff with us. She said, you know, I have stuff piled up in my china cabinet, and I've hadn't had it out in years. And she goes, what's the use in that? She said, you just need to understand, you're not taking any of it. Use it. Use your china. Give it to your kids or your grandkids. Understand. And I came away with, what we take with us, if you will, is the love, the energy of the love that we share with one another. How we treat one another is woven into, if you will, the DNA of our soul. That's the energy that goes with us. That's what we take with us, the love. How, at the end of the day, how do we treat one another?
The thing that I get from this is, in a lot of ways, you are offering kind of an atonement right there at the end and saying, hey, you did a good job. You can let go of this stuff now. You're on to the next class, the next element, the next stage. And so with that, have you given thought to your own transition? I mean, do you have a specific game plan in mind?
Well, I'm always telling my husband I get to go first. But, you know, I'm just so receptive to however long I need to be here. I enjoy my life so much. I'm happier than I've ever been in my whole life. I'll be 62 this year. And life is sweeter and sweeter and sweeter to me. I enjoy these opportunities to share with people these stories these patients have shared with me, and how they help me to grow and mature and wise up. So I have told my husband, if I have any kind of disease that is going to gradually take me out, I will go to the funeral home and sit with the director that is a good friend of ours, and do a video. I'll do my own service.
Okay, tell you what. We're going to take a break. Transitions, a Nurse's Education About Life and Death. Becky Hawkins is my guest. We're going to come back, and she's going to share a couple more of those really cool stories. There's a near-death experience that we're going to focus on. We'll come back in just a minute. Thanks for listening, Conscious Living.
Sassy! Sassy! this week's episode, Danger at the Old Well.
Last one to the old well's a rotten egg. Ha-ha, I win. Whoa! Sassy! Johnny fell down the well!
I'm wet!
What, Sassy? You know where Mr. Gunderson keeps his rope? Go get it, girl! What? You'd rather use this time to set people straight about shelter pet adoption?
I'm cold!
People shouldn't be afraid to adopt from a shelter? Because shelter pets are screened for sound health and temperament?
I'm wet and cold!
Sassy, what about Johnny? What? Let Johnny sit in the well until he learns to be more self-reliant? Sassy!
What'd he say?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it?
Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called InventNow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on, and lost cats stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See? That's proof. You should go to the InventNow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at InventNow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Come to the forest. It's a place not so far away. A place where you don't have to mow the lawn or babysit.
I saw lizards and squirrels and bugs.
Ladybugs, caterpillars. It's really cool, actually.
A place where you don't have to make time for free time.
Lots and lots of kinds of species here.
Out here, you may even meet the mysterious creature known as the other you. The enchanted you.
It's magic what flowers do.
The adventurous you.
My favorite tree, yes, is that one.
The free-to-be-me you. Ask your parents to take you to this not-so-far-away place. Come to the forest, where the other you lives. But first, stop by discovertheforest.org, a public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Talk about synchronicity. Hi here. I'm Wendy Garrett. My guest today is Becky Hawkins, a little PSA that was running there talking about come to the forest where everything is happy and perky and people are thrilled and there's a tree and the other you lives there. Won't that be fun? I'm like, oh, and what we're talking about with the transitions. Becky's book is called, and you can check it out at LadyHawkPublishing.com, Transitions. A nurse's education about life and death. And she's been doing this for about 30 years or so, assisting people, making their connection to the other side, transitioning. And what I found entertaining. Okay, so we talked about you planning your own service, and you've got that covered. That's good. I'm not so proactive. I'm going to let it just do whatever it wants to do because, you know, at that point, this is gone. And so yes. Anything that happens beyond that is somebody else's dream, you know? Yes. So it's that thing of, wow, it was so cool. And I just have that feeling now about all of it. It's just so cool. There's just this awe and miracles are everywhere. And you experience these time shifts and different dimensions and different, sometimes you see things that other people don't see and there's just no way to explain it. It just happens. And so when you've had this shift, it's like, okay, I don't have to explain it. I don't have to prove it. Man, I get to experience it. And that is enough. So from there, you've had these ladies and guys, these people who've had these near-death experiences, and they come back kind of jazzed. There was one about a lady who, she's like, don't you even try. You know who I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Exactly.
She's a dynamo. I love that.
Yes. She was so cute. Everything was pink. Her house was pink. The carpet was pink. She said, listen, before you do, lay a hand on me. I'm going to talk to you real clear right now. She said, if I even start to die, don't lay a hand on me. She said, I'm 82 years old. My heart's failing. I'm not going to have a heart transplant. I've been in ICU twice in the last few months. Get ready to die. And I'm dying, and I'm seeing the gates of heaven. I am moving on into the beautiful light, the music, everything, and then, bam, somebody shocks me with those paddles and brings me back. She said, that's happened to me twice. She said, I left telling those doctors they weren't going to get to do that again, and so they let me have you hospice nurses. She said, I want to make it clear to you before you do anything. If I fall over in this chair, don't touch me. She said, I'll haunt you whenever I do get to die, if you do. And I said, okay. I said, I'm on your side. I said, that works for me. And bless her heart, her neighbor found her gone the next morning in her recliner. Mm.
Nobody came in and did a preemptive maneuver.
Right. They let her go.
Well, I thought it was the part where you said that she said, I may be an old lady, but I'll have DNR tattooed on my chest.
Yes. I forgot about that part. Yes, she did. She said, I might be old, but I'm going to, you know, if I have to, I'll have DNR tattooed on my chest. And I thought, okay, well, we need to give this woman some support here and understanding that we're not going, because she was so afraid of somebody trying to keep her out of heaven. And in fact, I've heard people talk about that some of these spirits and some of these patients are ready to go, and machinery is keeping the body alive. And actually, the soul of the person is ready to move on. So, you know, there's a lot for us to be thinking about, you know, how long do we want to try to keep someone alive? And what do we want for ourselves? And we need to make that known, get that written down, and give that to other people. And as far as, you know, these ones that have had these near-death experiences, Wendy, the ones that I visited with, they don't care if you believe them or not. They are so happy in their space and their place as they are in this hospice program, knowing they believe that it's okay. The timing's perfect. It's all good. It's okay. I'm not afraid. I've been there before, and it's going to be all right.
Is there anything that they would like to tell others if they thought that people would be more receptive? Had they given in voice to that with you, or like with their relatives, is tell them, you know, to not to worry or not to grieve, because it's like you said, it's all good.
Yes. In fact, I have a list of a few things that they've shared with me along the way, and some of it is just so profound. But a lot of them, I never had any of them say, you know, I regret that I didn't get to work more. It was more like my regret is that I didn't spend more time stopping work at a certain time during the day and then going to play ball with my son. Or that I regret that I didn't spend more time talking to my parents. I regret that I didn't do more for the earth, do more for people that are suffering, people that are hungry. You know, they start leaning towards, you know, this is what I would do different. I had a gentleman that was elderly, and he had so much money, he didn't know what to do with it. And he said, now look, the family's moving in, and they're all going to try to take it. I wish I'd have started giving that money away earlier. And you're right, that they, especially those, if I could share the near-death experience my mother-in-law had, she had surgery. They thought it was cancer on her abdomen, and she wanted to get it. She was ready to go to surgery, and she was in her 80s. She said, go ahead, let's do that. I don't want cancer if I can keep from having it. And then weeks later, they removed this obstruction, which was not cancer, and she called, and she was in the nursing home and called me. She was looking for my husband, and she said, I need to talk to somebody. And I said, can I come? And she said, yes. So when I got in there, She very quietly whispered, because she didn't want any of the other residents to hear her. She said, I died when I was in the hospital. And because at that point I'd heard so much, I said, tell me what happened. And she said, well, all of a sudden, I was out of my body, I was in that surgery suite, and I was up in the corner of the room. And I was looking down, and I could see where the instruments were. I saw where the nurses were standing, the doctor, and I could hear them rushing around and saying, we're losing her, we're losing her. And she said, I felt like that was so strange because I thought, I'm not lost, I'm right here.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh my, that must have been very, very wonderful. And she said, yes. And she started smiling real big. I said, what else did you see? She said, I saw my family. And she said, I'm not afraid to die anymore. Because she had been afraid of death for many years since her first major stroke. And it was within 2 months that we got the call that she was in the emergency room and was in respiratory distress, could not breathe good. And we got there, and the doctor said, what do you want? And we said, we want a private room. They said, well, we really need to intubate her. And my mother-in-law held up her hand and shook her finger, no. So we got her in a room, pain medicine if she needed it, oxygen if she needed it. And this woman died peacefully, peacefully, within a few hours. She was not afraid anymore.
And I think in this instance, you know, it's difficult for the living to sometimes let go and to understand that is just as valid a caregiving position as trying to do all the, you know, mechanical resuscitation efforts. It's an honoring if that person is ready of their wishes and their beliefs. And, you know, just I think in our Western culture that is still a struggle, a big struggle.
Yes, Wendy, and this is what I hope for medical schools, that we can start bringing in, you know, this precious man on NPR yesterday and his story, sharing his mother's death on Twitter and all the precious things that he had to say. We need to bring death out of the closet and share with everybody so that there's not so much fear. But especially like these medical students, get that in there, that education in there somewhere, so that they understand, yes, they want to save whoever they can when that is what is supposed to be done and most right for that person. But some people are ready to go, and they need to be allowed to come off of a feeding tube, to move away from an IV if they don't want it anymore, and for everybody not to be afraid and understand that, yes, that's just as good, even better, caregiving. When we allow that person the dignity to have on their own terms their timing when they're nearing death, let them be in charge as much as you can. It's their life and it's their death. Yes, that's my hope, that we can learn this.
I always have to ask this, no matter what it is, but when they have animals or pets, is that ever another issue, another addition, have you experienced anything in that regard?
Yes. In fact, I was with one young lady who passed. I was with her for several hours, and her Cocker Spaniel followed, when the funeral home came to pick her up, followed that precious woman's body out. He was grieving so much. But another thing that some of these people that have had near-death experiences have told us, they see their pets that have passed on the other side. Their pets greet them. Sometimes mm-hmm. they see them in the tunnel, and oftentimes as they arrive, there are their pets.
See, my own experiences with animals is that they are very much a part of our energy, whether we see them now after they've crossed over or not. Mm-hmm. I've had experiences where they've been here, and that in other altered states, you know, that they are still part of my experience. And that is another element here that really connects us on a larger plane to all of the life in this in this space, on this planet, in this dimension, that we aren't just the body. We are connected to all of our companions and all of the life that is here. And that, I think, comes through in your stories, in what they're sharing, in bits and pieces. It's like, again, you know, these are breadcrumbs. These are ways of saying, what if this is another experience that somebody is sharing? And in that way, it is absolute truth for that person in that moment. And it's a way of us getting a piece of it in our own ideology or way of thinking, and then that's how we expand and how we evolve and grow.
Yes. I had somebody help me with that a few years ago by teaching me, an elderly person, saying, open your eyes, Becky. Open your eyes. Everything is alive. Everything has energy. The trees, the flowers, the earth, the water, the heavens, everything around you. We are not separated. We just think we are. But the energy just moves all together. We are one. And the sooner that we learn that we are not separate, it's not us against them. It's we are one. And we are all beloved. And all of this beauty that has been given to us in the creation of this place is alive, just like we are.
The one thing that I can ask, you know, is that there are so many dramas and there are so many condemnations of our lifestyle, our way of being, our way of doing, our way of eating, of seeing. And to get caught up in all of that, I think, is missing the point that while that may be a reality and a valid concern, if you just focus on that for the remainder or the duration of your life, you miss the dynamic, the full spectrum of all of the wonderful and miraculous things that happen while we are here. The fact that we still have new species that they're discovering, that we have old history that has been recovered and tells us that our beginnings aren't what we thought, that we are so much in the dark in a lot of ways that there is no lack of new to be discovered or awareness to be found if you just listen. And I love your book and your experiences, because that to me is a way of engaging a knowing and a wisdom that they are giving us in their last moments.
Yes. My brother's near-death experience was huge for me. That's the last chapter in my book. It's called My Brother's Keeper. And it was hard. It was a hard journey. But right after his diagnosis, he started choking one night. And when he called me, all I could hear was gasping. And I said, I'm calling an ambulance. I'll be right there. And I called my dad, who was in another room in the house. And I told him to get into him and get him up. I said he may have an occlusion because the tumor was all in his lungs and wrapped around his aorta. And when I got there, the ambulance was there, and they were getting ready to load him. He was purple, but he was breathing. Got him to the hospital, had him there 10 days. They started the radiation and chemo. Got him back home, and, you know, you have to go for radiation every day. And I'm driving him one of those days, and he tapped me on the shoulder. And he said, I about died. And I said, no kidding, you were purple. And he said, no, I about died, Becky. I said, what did you see? And he said, our mother, who died in 2002, approached him on the left, and a good friend of his that had committed suicide the year before approached him on his right. And he knew what was happening. And he said, please, 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 not yet, not yet. I've got work to do. And he said, Mother turned to him and said, then breathe, son, breathe. And then he was on the ambulance gurney. That helped him so much, because we were told as little kids, if you committed suicide, you went to a horrible place called hell. It changed everything for him, because he saw his friend who was, he said, you know, who looked fine and healthy and happy. And our mother was healthy and happy. And it blessed him so much, it helped him not to fear the next year that we went through, and then as he was dying, he had less fear because of that experience. And what you would hope is for people to not to have to have that fear in the first place. You know, read these stories. These stories are everywhere. Read these stories. Open your heart. Open your eyes, your mind. Don't be afraid to hear something you haven't heard before. It might change everything for you.
There are so many insights in those little stories. One of the biggest is that you don't have to be rich and famous. You don't have to have some kind of a big degree. You don't have to have some kind of a big, huge laundry list of accomplishments. You get to go forward.
Yes. It's because bless their hearts. You know, there's a lot of people that are so wound up, that's their whole existence is, will I gain fame and fortune? And you don't take any of that with you. You can if you want to. You can be famous if you want to. You can make a lot of money if you want to. But you might want to spend time. If everybody could spend time, maybe a few months, just visiting hospice patients and families, they might have a different ideal before them for how they want to spend the rest of their days here. And it's all fragile. It could turn on a dime right here in the next hour, and you'd be right out. So I think it's healthy to just think, what kind of footprints do I want to leave here? And how do I want to move forward, with fear or with excitement? I mean, I'm happy to be here. I want to be here as long as I can to do whatever I can, because I'm growing and learning all the time. But when it's time, I can't wait to meet my angels. I can't wait to meet those on the other side, see them again, and explore. There's so, so much that we're having revealed to us about the other side.
Well, the thing that I think is the most amazing and the most comforting is that, okay, as you're living and you're going through all the shoulds and I wish and I'm not a good enough person and I should have been kinder, I should have been more aware, I shouldn't have been so selfish, I should have shared, I should have, that's all still going to be there. Even when you have these moments of wow, you're still going to be you. And you're going to still make the dumb little mistakes and forget about things and wish that maybe things had been just a little bit different in your mind and you couldn't let go of some of your quirks. But that's the thing of this that's so beautiful, is that you can forgive yourself and continue to try to make adjustments and improvements to the best of your ability, and then forget what you were trying to adjust and improve to the best of your ability. And it doesn't go away. You still get to see the light. That's just all I can say, is that you can be human and still have these moments of the miraculous and the divine. They still exist, even with all of the faults and the failings that we put upon ourselves. It's still there. And it's available right now. You don't have to cross or transition. But if you read stories like what you are sharing, Becky, then you give yourself permission to maybe step outside a box or a limitation that has been imposed, whether it's self-imposed or by others around you who haven't been able to give you this awareness, not because they didn't want to, but they didn't have it, you know, and then you say, wow, and your life starts over. It just simply starts over.
If they can let go of the fear, so many people have a fear of anybody messing with their foundation. You know, this is my foundation of faith, and you're telling me that it's not exactly like this, then I don't know how to deal with it. So I've had people tell me that. I can't go where you are. And I'm saying, I'm not pulling, pushing, dragging anybody to go where I am. Everybody's got their journey here. We've all come, I think, to learn and to grow and to love. And so where you are, bless you. Where I am, bless me. And don't assign sainthood or sinner to anybody. We're all the same. We're all precious. We're all good. Yes, we make mistakes. This is Earth. We're human. But hopefully we can grow from our mistakes. Get up, brush ourselves off, move forward, understand there'll be more, and that's okay too, because that's how we learn.
I just figure, you know, when I mess up, that I'm somebody else's lesson and they'll get it right because I showed them how definitely not to do it. I'm telling you, this way don't work.
Yes. Well, I was the oldest of four children, and my two sisters that come behind me are near sainthood. They are amazing. And they grew up going, we're not going to do what she's done.
Yeah. You were the learning curve. The test bunny. There you go. Yep. Not doing that one. Yeah, I see it. That was had a nasty ending, didn't it?
Yeah.
I tell you what, though, the best part about it is when you fail enough, you realize it doesn't take anything away. You keep going. It's just a thing of, well, I'll try it a different way next time. And it gives you a perspective and I guess more compassion for other people when they go through those big hurdles, pitfalls, and failures, and knowing that, hey, this is part of being human. It takes learning both ends of the spectrum, how to win and how to lose, to become more fully aware of it isn't easy for anybody. It's just a path.
Yes.
Becky, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Wendy.
Your book is available through your website, Lady Hawk Publishing, and we would love to talk with you again.
Oh,
so I'll put
that.
You... put you on the list because you've got more stories to share. And if you're listening, again, Becky Hawkins, you can check her out on YouTube. I put some links on the Facebook page. And in the meantime, you know, share your own journey. Make some of your own wishes about these kinds of things known. And you'll just do a whole lot in doing that one very tiny move. I'm Wendy Garrett. This is Conscious Living. Thank you for listening. Have a fabulous day.